So tonight I'm going to continue on talking about the Fourth Noble Truth as part of my longer set of talks on the Four Noble Truths. And so last time where I talked about the first two steps, right understanding or right view and right intention, sort of making sure you understand why you're doing the practice, what motivates you to do the practice, and then heading in the right direction. And what interests me about the next three, wholesome speech, wise action, and conscious livelihood, is that the Buddha is talking about how you live your life. This is what's before he starts talking about effort and meditation and concentration and all these things. He says, how do you live your life? That's what we have to do first. Now, this is a constant theme in the Buddhist teachings. Wherever he went to a new place, he'd always talk about gratitude. He'd talk about sila, wholesome life. And it just fascinated me that that's what he does. He says, let's look at how you live your life in the world. Because if you're not living your life in the world in a wholesome way, then all the practice you could possibly do isn't going to make any difference. One of my teachers on retreat said something really interesting to me, because on retreat there's really three forms of practice, right? There's sitting practice, there's walking practice, and then there's like daily life practice, brushing your teeth and eating your meals and just going for a walk and all those sort of things. And he said that on retreat, often people sort of go, oh, sitting's most important, then the walking practice, and then all that other stuff. But what actually it should be is all that other stuff first, then walking practice, then sitting practice. You might look at it that way. And because if all are sitting like this or sitting in a longer retreat situation, if it doesn't prepare us to be mindful in our daily lives, in our out there in the world, brushing our teeth world, why are we bothering? Because it's not really changing how we live in the world. That's what's important. That's why this practice leads us to leading a wholesome life, especially as householders. If we were monastics, it might be slightly different. But we're all householders. Most of our time we spend living in the world. Anyhow. And the other thing is, if we can actually lead a life where we're mindful of how we're living our life and live a wholesome life, it's much more likely that our minds will be calm and still and clear when we actually do start to sit down and practice, when we start looking at the last three steps of the Eightfold Path. If we're leading a life of wild dissipation, boy, your mind's going to be all over the place anyway. So how is it possibly going to settle down when you go and sit? So that's another reason I think he did it in this order. So let's look at these three anyhow. So the first one is wholesome speech. And here's another thing that fascinates me. The Buddha put huge emphasis on speech. Not just here in the Eightfold Path, but in other places as well. There's this teaching called the 10 Unwholesome Acts of Body, Speech, and Mind. Four of the 10 are about speech. Speech is where we often go off the rails, I think would be a good way to put it. Speech is where it's so easy for us to do things that are less than wholesome. Out of habit, out of carelessness, out of lack of mindfulness, however you want to think about it. So let's look, but there's this list of these four particular areas of speech where the Buddha put great emphasis. The first one, of course, is this not telling the truth. This one seems obvious, but it's like, well, I'm not gonna tell them, give them a straight answer to that because it'll make them upset. And sometimes that not even be a wise thing to do. In certain situations, in family situations or in medical situations, you see that sometimes at the hospital, like, well, that person, we don't, it's not, they're not ready to hear this news yet. So let's just give them a day to get settled here before we start talking about these things. So sometimes it's wise to sort of hold back a little bit. But in general, telling the truth seems to be like the simplest thing in the world, and it's so hard for us to do sometimes. We tend to think, well, it's like, the little white lie, I'll stretch the truth a little bit because it makes me look good or makes me feel good that, because people think, wow, this guy must be great because he just said he does blah, blah, blah. Well, of course, doing blah, blah, blah is a wild exaggeration of what she actually does, right? And so we have to watch ourselves in these little ways. And here's one other thing about this, and this is a classic conundrum, and this I explain this when I'm sitting with a group of other people in a room. So say we were all sitting in a room and some guy bursts in the door with a gun in his hand and he says, "Is Carl here?" And believe me, I would say, "Carl? Carl who? I don't know any Carl." I would lie through my teeth just because that would be the skillful thing to do. So none of these things we're talking about are absolutes. We shouldn't take them as absolutes. It's like, 'cause then the flip side of that is some people say, well, I should tell him, I heard so and so told me that so and so did such and such, so I should make sure they know. That would be the honest thing to do. Well, sometimes that's just not so honest because it's hurtful, as a matter of fact. You have to sort of judge what you say, which comes into one of the other categories more usually. So that's the first one, not telling the truth. The second one is harsh speech, just growling. Yelling, being a grump, and that's one I've had to work a lot with myself. And it's so easy to do. It's like, you're not things aren't working out the way you want them to, and you start to growl and complain and bark. It never, ever, in any situation I've ever been in, has it made me happier or the other person I'm barking at happier? It's always caused more suffering. It just does. It doesn't ever work as a wholesome way to communicate with somebody else. I mean, but once again, there's exceptions. You're with a small child, they're with their hand on a hot stove element. Boy, I'm gonna yell. Watch out and grab their hand, make a because that would be the wise thing to do. So it's once again, no absolutes here. But generally speaking, 99.9% of the time, being harsh speech is just once again, it's sort of like I'm frustrated, so I'm letting my frustrations out through my speech. Okay. Next one, gossip. This is one that, it's just so easy to fall into because it's juicy. It's like, I know something and I'm going to tell you, but don't tell anybody that I told you. But, it's a way to make yourself feel important, to give yourself a sense of grandeur, and it's sort of like, I'm sort of in with the in crowd. I've got the good scoop. It always has a sense of harm towards the person being gossiped about. Always. Gossip, by its very nature, is harmful to the person who's being gossiped about. That's the truth of gossip. But it is so tempting because once again, it sort of builds our self-image up. I'm so cool. I know something and I'm going to share it with these people and I'll just be like the coolest person. They are all going to be amazed that I know this. And that's where we go. But we're always, always harming another person when we gossip. Without fail. Guaranteed that's what's going to happen. And then in this list of the four unwholesome acts of speech, the last one I love, it says useless speech. Just blather, in other words. And how often do we sort of engage in speech in situations just because maybe we're uncomfortable or there's something going on and we want to have our turn? Or it's like it's so easy to fall into just saying something, not because it needs to be said, not that it's useful in any way, but just because I want to get my acts in. I want to have my turn. I want to, or I want people to think I'm with it enough that I can engage in this conversation about the nuclear problems in Czechoslovakia or whatever, some obscure thing that, but oh, well, I heard once in this article on the New York Times, blah, 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 or wherever, however we do that. And once again, this is often has to do with our own discomfort, with not looking like we're with it, or not being comfortable with silence. Not being comfortable just to sit with someone and be with someone and not say anything and be perfectly okay. It's like often when we're with other people, it's like we feel like we should be engaging in conversation. Sometimes it's quite pleasant to sit with someone and say not a word. Just be there with them. It can be quite sweet. Just, you're looking at the birds together or whatever it is you're doing or going for a walk and there's no need for this chatter. But the chatter is like nervousness in a sense. It's like I have to fill in these blank spaces because I'm uncomfortable with silence. It's like a manifestation of this, I think, is I have some relatives who you go and visit them, and they always have the TV on. They're not watching it. It might be in another room even, but it's always on. It's like background noise. It's got to be something going on all the time, right? And that's like speech coming at you, and it's like it's soothing in a way. It's somehow or other for them to know that that's always there. Now, I understand for some people this is also a safety issue. It sounds like someone's home and there's someone here with you, and I can understand that level of it. But often it's just there in the background, totally useless speech. And so you can see from this list that this is like, boy, I have to actually stop and think about things before I say them. In other words, wholesome speech is a practice. Just like everything else in the Eightfold Path, these are all practices. Just like, wise intention was, you have to stop and think, is this really useful? Is this, am I heading in the right direction? This takes mindfulness. Well, wholesome speech, especially since in the world of day-to-day life, a lot of what we do is speak. It takes a lot of practice to really not fall into these areas of speech, not to sort of go over the edge of what seems appropriate. And I don't want to sort of be the wagging finger here. The reason I said these are practices is because sure enough, like any other practice, sometimes we're going to be really good at it, and sometimes we're just going to, for whatever reason, the emotional situation, we're tired, who knows, we're going to not be so perfect. We're going to fall into one of these areas. And then it's just like, sometimes it's like, oh, here I am going, doing that. Maybe I need to apologize if I'm gossiping to someone or about someone. Maybe I have to just say, oh, no, I'm sorry, I have to stop. I can't say, I can't do this. It's like, but it's like, and that's because mindfulness has kicked in, and we went, oh, yeah, here I am doing that not so wholesome speech thing I do. And we all have habits where one or more of these might be more, our tendencies. And so that takes some skill to sort of look at that and say, what's what? The problem, here's the problem with this list, is it sounds sort of like, the wagging finger, kind of harsh, right? But I wanted to just share a little something here with you. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, and he's just quoting the Buddha here. And he's saying, bhikkhus, possessing five factors, speech is well spoken, not badly spoken. It is blameless and beyond reproach by the wise. What five? It is spoken at the proper time. What is said is true. It is spoken gently. What is said is beneficial. It is spoken with a mind of loving kindness. It's a similar list, but now this is all stated in the positive. Here's like, if you can, before you say something, do I meet these five criteria? Is it spoken at the proper time? This is one I sort of alluded to earlier. Like, we know something about somebody and we think, oh, I should tell them because that would be the honest thing to do. Well, maybe it isn't, maybe it isn't. Maybe it isn't the right time at all. Maybe that person's already really upset about something, and you telling them this other thing is just going to, add another layer to their upsetness. Maybe you need to say, well, no, maybe I'll sit on this one for a while. And that's not being dishonest, it's just being aware of the situation. Is it at the right time? And is it true, which we already talked about? Is it spoken gently, so no harsh speech? Is it beneficial? This is sort of, it's a different, this is where the list starts to vary a bit, but I think that covers gossip pretty well. Gossip is never beneficial. Never beneficial. So is this actually useful? Is this of use to the person you're speaking to and to yourself for that matter? And is it spoken with a mind of loving kindness? Is this an act full of loving kindness? Is my heart full of loving kindness as I speak? This is quite a list to aspire to, but once again, this is all just practice. This is just looking at it from a slightly different angle, I suppose, is the best way I could put it. So that's wholesome speech. Another thing that's often talked about, I won't spend much time on it, but also part of wholesome speech is wholesome listening. Can I actually, when I listen to someone, really listen to them? Not be, as they're speaking, framing my answer, my 2 cents worth about what they're saying, and not really hearing what they're saying at all, because I'm too busy thinking of what I'm going to say next. Which often turns into useless speech. That's where a lot of useless speech arises, just there. Can I really just offer my full attention to someone when they're speaking? It's a really powerful gift when you can give that to someone, because then people feel they're worthwhile. It's like, oh, this is really something that is being taken in. It's a powerful, powerful gift you can give to someone. I mean, I know if you're a therapist, you understand this already, hopefully. But this is where we can really be helpful in the world. It's just to really just listen and not be caught in figuring out what we're going to say next. Just listen. Just really open-heartedly take it in. Okay. Then we have wise action. So this is now beyond, I mean, speech is a form of action, but now we're talking about actually doing things, with our body. And This is usually expressed in the Theravada tradition by something called the five precepts. And once again, I want to point out these are not hard and fast rules. They are practices. So we have to think about what they mean to us in a particular situation and what they mean to us personally. And for some of us, these might have totally have different flavors and nuances. So I want to make sure we think about it that way. So the first one of these is non-harming. Once again, it sounds pretty obvious, thou shalt not kill, right? But it's much more than that. I mean, and you can take this as far as you want, but you think, am I harming the world by dumping the oil from my, when I change my oil, dumping my oil down the sewer? Yeah, I am. I'm harming the world. And that's why people don't do that anymore. I'm thinking back in the old days when we always still change our own oil, right? But it was like people would just dump it down into the storm sewers and off it would go into the rivers. And this was harming the world. And we can think about all the things we do. Think about everything you do. Is it harming the world? Not just harming like killing or damaging, but is it like, does this harm things or is this wholesome? So not harming also, this is where in the Buddhist tradition, particularly in the Theravada tradition, people are vegetarian and vegan for exactly this reason, because it's not harming. I'm not going to say you should be. It took me a long time to become a vegan. I was a vegetarian for a long, long time. But for me, vegetarian when I first started was, well, I'm still going to eat eggs because they're not alive, so it's okay. I took over, it's been 50 years or so I've been working with this. And I'm still working on it. I'm still working on it. But you sort of see, gradually move in a direction where you think, that's harming. If I eat that dead animal, I'm harming. I caught something, someone, I just paid someone to cause harm for me. I didn't harm them myself. That's where our mind goes, right? But that's what the truth is. This is harming. And everybody has to take this, I mean, for however it works for you. And like I said, it's a very progressive sort of thing. So I'm not saying you should all rush out and be vegan if you're not already. But think about it at least. The next one, and this is what on retreat, this one is said to be taking only what is offered. So on retreat, and in the monastic tradition, whatever's there for a meal, for instance, that's what you eat. That's what's offered. You go on retreat and you get assigned a room. That's what was offered. End of discussion. It's not like, well, I need a special space, or I need to get into the kitchen and I got to spice this food up because I don't like it the way it is, or blah, 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 blah. People, it's so easy to get caught up in those sorts of things about having things the way you like them all the time, instead of just taking what is offered. But I think as householders, we can expand this one into thinking about, do I have too much stuff? Do I really need all the stuff I have? Can I have function in the world with less stuff? And we all need stuff. We're householders. Like we need, a fridge and a stove and those sorts of things. But do I, I saw this, I worked for a long time in carpentry in that, and I used to work with other guys. And there were guys who would have like four skill saws. Because, well, this one's a little bit better, and I like this one, and I saw this one, it was on sale. And it's like, you don't need four skill saws. I'm sorry, you need one that works. That's all you need. Just need one of each. I mean, now I only have one of them. One of them died, so now I only have five different kinds of power saws. But I used all of them for different kinds of jobs in carpentry. They all, but I only had one of each. Even though I'd sort of walk through the tool department at McGuckin's and have to sort of, put my blinders on and not look at the, oh, it's like walking through a candy shop for a kid, you know? No, I don't need any more of these things than I already have. It's really an interesting thing to do, to look at all your stuff and go, do I need this stuff? Do I really need all this stuff? And then give it away. There's lots of places you can give stuff away to that will put them to really good use. Goodwill shops, and my favorite is Arc Thrift, because it helps people who are disadvantaged. So I go there about twice a year. My wife and I sort of go through, oh, here's some more stuff to take to Arc Thrift, and we'll take another bundle of stuff away. Part of it might be getting older, and so we want to have less stuff, but it's just like, just taking only what is offered also means not taking more than you need. It's harmful to the world to have more, all this stuff that you don't need. Harmful to the people who don't have that kind of stuff for some reason, who can't afford it perhaps. Give it away. Just give it away. It's like, doesn't have to be a big deal. Just, I don't need this anymore. Out it goes. Then the next one of these actions. Interestingly enough, here we are in the five precepts. The next one is correct speech. Oh, we already talked a lot about speech. I won't go through that all again. Except on retreat, of course, correct speech means silence. And it can be really interesting to choose to be silent. I would recommend, if you're really sort of curious about exploring this, have once in a while, have maybe just half a day. You get up on Sunday morning, you don't have to go to work or anything or whatever, and just say, okay, not going to turn on my computer. I'm going to turn my phone off. I'm not going to open a book, because reading is a form of speech. And just be silent for 4 hours and see what it's like. It's kind of an interesting experiment, just to sort of go, I don't need to get involved in that world of words all the time, which is where we live all the time. It's very, when we're not stimulating that part of the brain, which is a distinct part of the brain that processes speech, the part of our brain that processes things on a more instinctual, intuitive level wakes up more. Just, if we can just go away from words for a while. That's why silence on retreat is such a big deal, because it's taking people away from the world of words into the world of intuition, into insight. Okay. The next one. This is a hot topic, right? Refraining from sexual misconduct. And I'm not going to give you a long moral lecture here, but I think it's really interesting to look at this one in the context of the others. So refraining from sexual misconduct means not causing harm to another being through sexual conduct. Non-harming. Oh, isn't that, think of what that means, right? It's quite clear. Taking only what is offered. That's another interesting one in terms of sexual misconduct or proper sexual conduct. Taking only what is offered. Correct speech, not gossiping about it. For instance, not being the cool guy who has all, or I had, you know who I was with last night, Sad but true, I grew up in the world where that was part of what was going on in my college life anyway. And then the fifth of these, I wanted to mention this because it's in this same context. Is not abusing alcohol and drugs that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. Well, think about that in terms of sexual misconduct. Is that person drunk, high? Am I drunk, high? Oh, maybe my judgment is a little clouded here. Maybe I should just step back. Not now. And it's so, and it's so easy, because that's often where we loosen our inhibitions, so we don't notice how fact that we're actually acting in an unskillful way. Certainly, that was my life in college for sure. And I'm not just speaking of college, later life too, and it happens all the time, unfortunately. So these now the, here's the interesting thing. These five precepts, as I'm talking about this, have to do with being a householder. But they're also, when monastics take vows, these are the first five vows. These are the first five steps of becoming a monastic. And the Buddha talks about these things all the time. He's, in fact, there's a sutta where he says, first of all, do this. And when you're okay and comfortable with this, then come and talk to me about more difficult things. This is really difficult to live this way, to actually live by these precepts. These aren't hard and fast rules. They're not like, there's not like, a rule in the sexual misconduct category that says, only between a man and a woman. Or only between two people for that matter. There's no wagging fingers here. This is just, how can I lead a wholesome life with my actions in the world? Joseph once again had something interesting to say about this, of course. So much of what the Buddha taught seems so obvious. Don't kill, don't steal, don't harm. Still, as we try to apply and practice this in our lives, we can come to the forward edge of our understanding and commitment. And this edge can be a challenging place to be. One teacher commented that if practicing the precepts doesn't make us uncomfortable, it's probably a sign we should investigate them more deeply. I love this sentence because it points to something. It says, if practicing the precepts doesn't make us uncomfortable, it's probably a sign that we should investigate things more deeply. It's so easy to fall into the, oh, I'm a good person, I'm okay state of mind. But practicing the precepts actually should make us a little uncomfortable sometimes. Ooh, I never thought of it quite that way. Sort of time. I appreciate this comment because it points to these steps in the path as actual practices, things to understand and investigate in our lives, rather than taking them it for granted that we're basically good people and then looking no further. Practices. These are all practices. And it's really important that we avoid the tendency to beat ourselves up when we're not perfect. Because they're practices. Practices imply that you're going to make mistakes, that you're not going to be perfect. And so we have to have a little self-compassion here. We have to be able to go, oh, yeah, there I was. I felt it full, fell into that old pattern I have. And there I was yelling at someone again. Or whatever it was I was doing. Oh, okay. And see that and then sort of, resolve to be more mindful. Because mindfulness, how are we going to follow these precepts? Because we're going to follow them because we're being mindful. If we're really mindful of these precepts, the practice of these precepts blossoms. Because we're leading a mindful life. We're being paying attention to what how we're acting in the world. Okay. Then we come to the third category here. And this is, I find initially this is even here, for one thing. It's like the Buddha actually said, oh, how you make a living in the world, how you find your livelihood is actually quite important. So, this actually conscious livelihood, we can't divorce our practice from probably how where we spend more time in our life than any other time, how we actually function in the world to make a living and keep a roof over our head and food on the table. We can't separate that out and go, oh, well, that's separate from my practice. at all. We can't do it. Because we spend, especially in our adult life, we spend a huge amount of time in that world, making a living, as they call it, right? So the Buddha, first of all, I want to point out, the Buddha was very explicit about what the ways of making a living that are definitely incorrect. And you see how all of these fall very directly under the five precepts. Trading in weapons and instruments for killing. Well, I mean, that's right up there with the non-harming list, right? Slavery. And you may think, well, slavery, that's something that used to be. Well, in our country, it certainly was. But the truth is, it still is to this day. I have a friend, a student, and a friend who is a longtime police officer, and he works with a squad in the Denver area that deals is the anti-slavery squad, where people, mainly women, young women, of course, are literally enslaved for sexual purposes. It's like that's what happens today, right here in Denver, Boulder area. You'll find people who are slavers, living off the avails of other people's efforts. It's just so clearly incorrect, right? The production of meat and killing of animals. Hope none of you are farmers. But the production of meat and killing of animals. He said very explicitly, this is harmful. It's harming the animals. I won't go any further with that one. Manufacturing and selling alcohol and drugs. Because these things tend to have people, lead to heedlessness in their lives. Making or selling poisons. Because they're used to harm, right? And finally, this, I love this one. Any profession that involves deceit. I won't go there, but it's like, how often is there a profession, part of like being a good used car salesman is sort of, building, making the car sound better than it really is. For instance, having been caught that way once myself, to be honest with you. But it's like there are lots of ways you can make money that involve that sort of thing. Oh, maybe, And so once again, these are just, most of these, I don't think any of you are probably directly involved in any of these things, but I don't know. And then I think, oh, wait, in our culture, we also own stock, some of us. We own investments. Are those investments in things like this? Do we have to think about that? That's an honest thing we have to stop and think about. Because there's a whole huge thing going on in certainly in North America. I don't know what in Europe, but in North America, where this the whole thing of ethical investing has become a really big issue because of exactly these sorts of things. Once again, I'm not going to push this, but it's like it's something we have to go, oh, never thought of that way. I have this mutual fund and money comes in and like it's nice to have it and. Wait a second, where's that money really coming from? Is it coming from people who do exactly these things? I have to think about that when we do things. The Buddha also, by the way, said, here's the things that the most conducive perfections. If you're going to be a householder, here's the two things that you probably are really good. Teaching and farming. These are helping the world. Teaching. Being a teacher, either in the sense of teaching children in a school or whatever, or being a teacher within the Dhamma community, or farming, growing food so that people can be fed. These are really wholesome things to do. Especially back, remember this is back 2,500 years ago where there wasn't any sort of giant agribusiness farming going on. It was all like done individually, and little people had little farms. And we have to think a little bit more about that now, these days, than we would have back 2,500 years ago. But here's the truth. Back in the day, back to 2,500 years ago, well, that's basically, this is the Buddha lived in a very agrarian world, and that's what people were. They were either teachers or farmers. Pretty much everybody was either had a little, subsistence farm, and their family lived there, and they had whatever they had, going, or they were monastics and they taught. There wasn't a lot of formal, like, kids send kids off to school in the morning kind of thing, that the way world we live in now. So how does this idea apply to the world that we live in? And I think the main thing here is, can we approach how we live in the world, how we make a living in the world, with an attitude of service? How I make my way through the daily life to bring in income, to make sure I get three squares a day and a roof over my head? Can that also be an act of service? And I don't necessarily mean just, serve, be working in a quote service profession, and there's lots of those. Being a therapist, being a nurse or a doctor or a veterinarian or whatever, there's lots of those sorts of professions. But also, just like, can I, in my daily interactions with people I work with, no matter what I do, really, no matter what I do, can I look at that as being an act of service? Can I consciously be a wholesome energy within that workspace? That's a way to be that's an act of service, to actually make the workplace, the situation where you work, be more conducive to people being happy. That would be a real act of service. And it doesn't now you don't have to be a teacher or farmer. You could be a mechanic in a garage. You could be anything. But if you're doing it with that sort of heart of loving kindness, of trying to be of service to the world, to these people you're working with, that would be a huge thing in the world. That would be conscious livelihood in our more complicated world than the Buddhist time, where things were somewhat more cut and dried. And one other thing I want to point out about livelihood. Because it's pretty easy, if we're not careful, to go into the space of, oh, it's wrong to be wealthy. It's like, that's having too much, right? It's not what the Buddha said. This is, I came across this. This is a book called What the Buddha Taught by Walpola Rahula, who was I forget what, some Middle European person who went and became a monastic in Sri Lanka, and then came back to and wrote this book, among other things. Once the Buddha told Natthapindika, the great banker, one of his most devoted lay disciples who founded for him the celebrated Jetavana Monastery, that a layman who leads an ordinary family life has four kinds of happiness. Happiness here being equated to living a proper life. The first happiness is to enjoy economic security or sufficient wealth acquired by just and righteous means. What we were just talking about, right livelihood. It's okay to have sufficient wealth for economic security. The second is spending that wealth liberally on himself, his family, his friends, and on meritorious deeds. In other words, dana. Not being able to be generous, to be able to not just hoard whatever wealth you have, but to share it with the people less fortunate. Is what it means by meritorious deeds. The third is to be free from debts. And when I first came across this, I sort of went, huh? But it's like, think about it. Think about what, when you're in debt, and our culture certainly strongly encourages us to be in debt, then you automatically are always having to do things or work or keep working more than you want to work or doing work that maybe isn't exactly what you want to do because you've got that debt and you got to pay it off. One of the best things I ever did in my life, because like everybody else, as a householder, I had kids and I needed a house and I bought a house, right? But of course, you didn't just buy a house, you got a mortgage. And I luckily had a mortgage with a balloon clause in it, which allowed me to put extra money in once a year. Man, every year I put money in. And I got out of debt in 11 years. Worked hard, really hard. And we didn't do a lot of fancy vacations and stuff like that. But it was like, it was such a relief to be out of debt because now I could go, oh, now I have some choice in my life. I don't have this debt hanging over me. Now, it's pretty hard in our culture not to go into debt and say, buy a house these days. I mean, or even a car for that matter, which we need a car to get around and that sort of thing. But it's like, can I consciously, if I choose to go into debt, then do everything I can to get out as quickly as I can so that I don't have that debt nagging at the back of my mind all the time. And the Buddha was like, he said, just be free from debts was one of the four great things that make people happy. And speaking from personal experience, when I got out of debt and haven't been in debt since, and this is going on 30 years now, it was one of the best things I ever did. One of the best things. It just freed me to go, oh, I think I'll take a month off and go sit. I had more time to practice. I had more time to do things I wanted to do because I didn't have to worry about making that damn payment at the end of the month. There was a lot more flexibility in my life. It's an interesting place to think about in terms of our culture and what it means to be in debt. And of course, the fourth happiness is to live a faultless and pure life. So, living a life of a wholesome life is one of the great happiness. So it's like three of these had to do with making money, spending money, having wealth and using it wisely, taking being thing and trying not to be in debt. And the fourth one is lead a virtuous life. The Buddha all the time talked about the bliss of blamelessness, which I think is a great phrase. I always liked it. The bliss of blamelessness. If we can really follow the precepts and lead, have a conscious livelihood and be careful with our speech, then we could live with the bliss of blamelessness. It just means that because every time you practice and mess up, which we're all going to do, then we get caught in that whirling mind of, oh my God, how could I have said that? I shouldn't have. Now they're going to think I'm a jerk and blah, blah, blah. And we just get caught in that whirling mind and just gets in the way of our mind being still, which is what we're trying to do with our practice. So it's okay to live in a world where you actually make money and spend money and do all those sort of things that people do. Just be aware. Just be conscious of it and share what you have with others in some way. Find ways that work for you. So, in summary, as they say, there's a lot to pay attention to here. And what I'm suggesting is we have to look at our entire life. Everything we do, how we make a living, how we speak in the world, how we act in the world, what we consume and how we consume it. And it's like, wow, there's a lot here. And it means that we actually have to stop and really think about it. We have to do, as Joseph says, if thinking about this doesn't make us a little bit uncomfortable, Maybe we're not looking closely enough. If there isn't sort of like sort of shifting in your seat sometimes. Oh, yeah, I guess I'd better. Yeah, I can see where I could have done being more skillful there. And that's it all comes from being mindful as we go about our daily life, our daily routines. Can I be mindful as I do that? Because the mindfulness is what's going to help us practice skillfully in these worlds. Of course, I have a little bit of poetry at the end here. This is actually only, I'm just going to read a little, like 3 lines out of this poem. This is from Mary Oliver's poems, A Thousand Mornings. And I read this and I went, it's perfect. And also very much in line with what I've been talking about. I know I can walk through the world, along the shore or under the trees, with my mind filled with things of little importance, in full self-attendance. A condition I can't really call being alive. Yeah. Again, I'm little, in full self-attendance. Just thinking about myself all the time. What's going to make me happy? What's going to be me, mine. I, me, mine, all the time. In full self-attendance. And you can be, like she says, you're walking through the world under the trees, vibing, like you're just having a nice walk in the forest. But if your mind is whirling around in full self-attendance, instead of just taking in the beauty of the trees, perhaps, being mindful. And it's a condition I can't really call being alive. It's a pretty strong statement. But it's an interesting one. It's an interesting way to look at it. Can I not be so full of self-attendance all the time?